Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Golic and Smetty here. Oh, no. No, there's a place for cheese and it's not dessert. Welcome to another edition of Golic and Smetty. I am Mike Golic Sr. She is Jess Matana. And Jess, before we move forward to what's going on, I want to thank you for not waking me up either at night or in the morning when you and your boyfriend came to the Notre Dame Clemson game. You guys stayed at our house the night of the game, and you came back to our house after Chris and I were already home and went to bed, and you left the next morning before we even got up. So I'm very impressed with how quiet you were coming back into the house.
Well, Mike, you left the Notre Dame Clemson game at halftime, so yeah, we got home later than you and your wife, and I was stunned that A, you didn't stay for the whole game, and B, the dogs didn't even bark when we walked in. I was expecting a hero's greeting from Hank and Ted, and I got nothing. And I was very upset, but you're right. We did creep in and out. We kind of like slunk in and slunk out in the morning to get back to Chicago to make our flight. But I was bummed. I wanted to talk about the game with you.
Yeah, that wasn't happening. We rarely stay, especially a night game. We don't stay for the whole game because part of it is leaving the dogs for that long, you know, especially if we have to put Ted in the cage because he's a chewer. We're thinking of our dogs. And then once we got home, we started to get tired and we were like, screw this. We'll watch the rest of the game in bed and the dogs sleep in bed with us. So and even when we got up and I was kind of walking loudly and the dogs were kind of barking and Chris was like, quiet, you know, Jess and her boyfriend, they're still sleeping. I said, no, they left. I said, they left already. She's like, oh my God, I didn't even hear them last night. So good job out of you. Well done. Just wanted to say that you are welcome anytime at the house when you don't make noise like that.
I appreciate it. I also made the bed on the way out. I don't know if that counts for anything. Mike, I'm dying to know what you thought of the cookies that I brought you.
They were phenomenal. I mean, listen, I have not had anything yet that you've made that has not been phenomenal. You are an ace baker and you did not disappoint. So you came to the house with food in hand. So I always appreciate that.
Keep the compliments coming.
Making the bed, that's more my wife. You scored points with her than me. I don't give a shit if you make it or not. But you doing that certainly was made my wife very happy that you took the time to do that, because we have definitely had people stay there before that would not do that. Not that that's the end all be all, but it is a very nice touch on your part. So
Stu Gatz wouldn't have done it.
Oh, Stu Gatz, are you kidding me? He'd have stolen something from my house, let alone not made the bed.
Oh, he would have stolen the bobblehead.
Yeah,
I wanted
yeah.
to steal the Mike Golic Jr. bobblehead I saw on my way out, and I had my eyes on it, but I didn't take it.
You should have. There. You should have. I don't care if it's there. Doesn't matter to me. All right, so that was cool. Now, before we get to sports, I have to ask you some very important question.
Ooh, okay.
We are not yet at Thanksgiving. We're getting there, so we'll talk next week about food and Thanksgiving and sides and all that kind of stuff. But I need to know from you, when do you believe it's okay to put up Christmas decorations?
Mike, I think my preference is the Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's differing opinions on this. I know that your son is a big believer that Christmas is year round or something
pretty
crazy
much
like that. But yeah. Why? What do you think?
Oh, as soon as Halloween's over, Christmas stuff goes
okay
up. Because
I'm fine with that. I don't judge anyone for putting it up. Like, my neighbors have Christmas stuff out right now, and
right,
that's okay. But I'm going to wait until after Thanksgiving because I personally enjoy the fall aesthetic. I like all the pumpkin things and the gourds and the leaves and all that, and,
right,
and like flannels and plaids. So I wait because I like to extend the Halloween season out a little bit.
See, now I appreciate that because you like doing that, but you don't have a problem if somebody decorates Christmas-wise, because I've gotten to battles over this of people that say I am just absolutely wrong for wanting to do this. But we are one of those, we changed to the holiday stations right away on XM. You know, we got
okay,
those going right away.
Yeah.
I think one of them is Holly, it's 104. So that's one of them. There ends up being a few of them. And I mean, the day after Halloween, man, we are down with the pumpkins and up with the Christmas decorations, the Christmas music. We love doing that. So it's always an interesting battle that I have with people about that. But I like your responses. Hey, you do you and I'll do me. I think that's the way to go.
I think that's just, you know, holidays, people are always going to have their preferences. And it usually stems from whatever you did when you were growing up. My family always put up Christmas the Saturday and Sunday after Thanksgiving while we were usually watching the Bears lose on Fox.
Oh,
so that's just our family tradition. Yeah.
Yeah. And now Thanksgiving, a lot of times, you know, my wife would put up the decorations because I actually played on Thanksgiving twice when I was playing in the league. And then, you know, you're just worried about Thanksgiving and stuff. But Chris always had, and we usually put up two trees as well.
Really?
Now, here's the
that
other thing.
That seems really extra. But
I know. We're kind of over the top. Do you put up a real tree or a fake tree?
I haven't put up a tree once in my adult life.
What? Wait.
I've never had the space for it.
So you can, there's different sized trees. You can find space for a little tree.
I've never gotten my own tree.
Oh my. So the apartment you live in Miami, you're saying,
yeah,
will be Christmas treeless.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any plans to put up a tree right now. I'll get Christmas themed, like, tea towels. Oh, you look like you're about to kill me. I'm terrified.
I am distraught. What does the boyfriend have to say about this?
Well, he celebrates Hanukkah, so I don't think he has a strong preference about Christmas trees either. But
yeah,
neither of us. I mean, I actually, you know what? I will say, last year or the year before, when we couldn't go to my parents' house for Christmas because of COVID, we've like never been able to celebrate a real Christmas because we started dating right around the pandemic happening.
Right.
But we did put up a really tiny fake tree from Target. So I take it back.
Okay.
I've had one like 2 foot tall Target tree that was completely fake and like probably terrible for the environment. And it got thrown away right after Christmas. But we put a couple ornaments on it. We had a J ornament for me and a W for my dog. And that was Christmas. So we have done that. And I do love string lights. I will string up some string lights to give my apartment a cute little ambiance. But that's really kind of all I do.
All right. I'll take that. Now, we used to have real trees all the time. Now, those you have to water because, again, we put up our tree and it's up for a long time. I mean, it's up before Thanksgiving and it's get taken down probably a week into the new year. So it's up for a while. So you have to water it. And
yeah,
I would always forget and I would always dry it out. It gets very dry and becomes a real big fire hazard if you dry it out. And then all the needles fall off. It's a freaking mess getting rid of it. And
how do the dogs do with the tree, the real tree? They don't like attack it?
Wait, no, they attack the ornaments, and then we just have to go through the process of saying don't do that,
don't
do that. And teach them. Years ago, we also had a cat as well with our dogs, and the cat
really
would climb up the tree, like up the inside of the tree.
Cats are wild.
Yeah,
man.
Cats are. This is a great cat. It was like a dog. It would fetch. We would throw its like mitten, and it would fetch it and bring it back. But I kept drying out the trees, and my wife gave me one more chance, and I screwed it up, of course. So we have now had a fake tree. We've been married 35 years. I would say we've probably had a fake tree for 20 of them now.
Yeah. You know, there's pros and cons to it. The fake tree you have to store somewhere, obviously. That's a pain in the ass. You have to, like, take it out of the box. It's usually dusty, and you have to, like, shake out all the branches and, like, you know, set them up so it looks like a tree. It can be a pain or a hassle, but it doesn't die and it doesn't shed.
Right.
And, you know, it's just a little bit more convenient.
The fake trees of today, Jess, since you have not put trees up in a while, are amazingly convenient on how easy they are to set up. Yes. And I just got the nod at the taping of this. The day we're taping this, my wife happened to say to me, pull out the tree today. Let's get the tree out. Let's get going on that. So that's all starting.
That's exciting.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited for you. Yeah. If I ever become a homeowner, I will buy a really nice fake tree.
Yeah.
When I'm 45, that's my plan.
When you're 45, you
buy a house. My generation doesn't own things, Mike.
Right.
I'll be renting forever.
Understood. When you're 45, good. That's almost two decades from now. My God.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. But all I know is the holiday season will be good to anybody around you, because I know you'll be a baking fool.
I packed my bags for Thanksgiving and I put two pie tins in it that I'm taking on the plane with me.
That's my girl.
I need to bake some pies next week. We will get more into the pie baking on next week's episode, because we have a lot. I'm sure you have a lot of Thanksgiving food.
Lots of food things to talk about. Yeah.
We'll postpone that until now, but I'm really happy for you that you're finally going to be able to put the tree up when we're done with this.
Yeah, that's I am too. And then I got to find another tree, because for some reason the wife likes two trees, and why am I going to say no at this point? I mean,
double
why?
The Christmas. Yeah,
that's exactly it. I think it's more because we've had two trees for a while and we have ornaments for two trees. So she feels if she doesn't get two trees, we're wasting ornaments packed away.
Yeah. We should get you a Golic and Smetty ornament.
That's what we need. Good call. And
producer Drew, get on that.
Segueing into our college football portion of this show is we just got our Notre Dame. Every year Notre Dame makes a
The ornament. My parents get that.
Yes. There you go. we got the ornament. So the Notre Dame ornament, and we get to celebrate another Notre Dame victory. Over Navy, this one looked like we had it in the bag in the first half, and then we decided the second half to look like some of the games where we lost, and Navy got back into this one and made it way closer than it should be. But listen, this is the year, really any year is the year. A win's a win. You take it no matter how you can get it.
I think playing Navy the last two decades is a win is a win. Like, Notre Dame had a probably 40-year stretch where they beat Navy every single year. And then in, like, the early 2000s, Navy got a few wins in there. And now I think Notre Dame fans are just scarred by it.
Yep.
And they're just happy to come away from that series with a win, no matter how ugly it is. Because we talked about on the show with Gojo last week, preparing for the triple option is not a joke. It's not fun, especially late in the season. Players get hurt. It's a completely different style of play. It's a train wreck. It stinks. And so winning is winning. Mike, I do have one question for you, which I noticed in the second half when Notre Dame was not playing as well and Navy was able to come back a little bit into the game. Drew Pine was getting blitzed a lot, and he was having trouble getting rid of the ball quickly. Is that something that's like you have to coach a player to do? Or is that something that is just because the offensive line isn't giving him enough time? Like, where do you put the blame in that situation in that game?
A lot of it depends on the blitz. Now, sometimes you blitz more players than the offense has to block, and you get a man coming free. Or you'll blitz and you'll overload a side and try and confuse protection so that somebody comes free. A rule is if they blitz more than you have to block and someone comes free, the quarterback's responsible for that person. They have to know it and they have to get rid of the ball. If you have enough blockers to block and they just get beat or get confused, that muddies the water a little bit. Then it becomes, does the quarterback have the vision to see the person that is blitzing? And then again, it's on them to get rid of the ball. So if they can somehow, some way. So there are different rules for blitzing. A lot of time, less often you'll see that all-out blitz where you bring more numbers than the offense has to block. A lot of times you'll confuse by twisting or things like that to confuse the O-line. Then it's on the O-line if they didn't, you know, brush off a person or if the back missed a pickup. A lot of times you'll leave a tight end to chip somebody so they can't get a rush. So it can be a gray area. But if somebody's coming free and the quarterback sees them, a lot of times that quarterback has got to know where he's going with the ball, because you have to understand where blitz is coming from. That's normally an area where you think it can then throw the ball. And it's also up to the receiver to recognize a blitz, cut off his route if they're on the side of the blitz, and get in that area where the blitzer's coming from to give your quarterback a place to throw the ball. So it's not completely cut and dry. But that surprised me. And the fact that Navy was getting back into this game, now they rush for a lot of yards, they always do, but they were passing the ball well. Now they had the backup quarterback come in because the starter got hurt, and the backup is a little more of a passer. But still, you should never get beat by the passing game of the Naval Academy. That just shouldn't happen.
That's, I mean, I was looking at the second half, like, play-by-play after the game, and it did seem like, yeah, that Navy was beating Notre Dame on the pass a lot. But, like, in reality, Notre Dame allowed them to score a field goal, which was a weird choice by the Navy coach to kick a field goal after a 10-minute drive that went, I think, 88 yards to start the third quarter. And then they forced a few three and outs, and then towards the end of the game, Navy scored again and kind of garbage time touchdown and kicked the onside that Notre Dame got back. So it wasn't like a bad defensive performance, I thought, in the second half. It was just that the offense was able to do so little after halftime that Navy really had a chance to come back and make it interesting. So I know Navy obviously has a lot different types of players than what Notre Dame will play the rest of the season against BC and USC. But is the way that they were able to corner the Notre Dame offense repeatable in those final two games?
Well, I mean, listen, there are two ways to approach Drew Pine, who's not a great passer. You can rush four, try and get it. A lot depends on your line. If you can rush four and drop seven and don't give him a lot of places to throw the ball, you can have success. Or if you blitz him and make a quick decision, you can have him make some mistakes as well. So, Drew, you know, we know the game before, Drew had himself a heck of a game, especially with his legs. He ran well. And I think that would work for him going forward because he's not a great passer. But to make a few play with his legs, to have that there and the defense then have to respect that, that could help out his passing game as well. A lot will depend on if a team can rush four or not. If a team can rush four, they can play, you know, seven deep in a pretty basic defense and pick their spots to blitz. But if they can't get pressure in four, now you're forcing them to bring more. Now that's an advantage for Drew Pine in that offense. So it's amazing to me, though, when there were six games left, it was three against ranked teams and three against unranked teams. And we were talking about hopefully they can win the three unranked and become bowl eligible. Well, they've beaten two of the three ranked teams. They have now beaten. Syracuse was ranked and Clemson was ranked. And the last one they'll get after BC, a game they should win again. But we know that's a tough statement at times this year. Then they'll get USC on the road. So that would be something. So if they run the table, they'd be 9-3. If they don't, they'll be 8-4. They'll go to a decent bowl game. I guess in your mind, is either one a successful ending for you, 8-4 or 9-3? Certainly 9-3 looks better.
9-3 looks a lot better, especially if you win the bowl game and then you're 10-3, which I think looks great. I mean, anytime you get double-digit wins on a season, I think is a great thing for a coach to have on the resume. But I think on paper, if you showed me 8-4 or 9-3 at the beginning of the season, I'd probably be, maybe not 9-3, 8-4, I would certainly be disappointed.
Right.
But then if you told me that the starting quarterback got hurt in week two, I would understand.
Right.
I think it's really impressive the way Notre Dame has been able to rebound from the Buckner injury and win some of those games that looked like the games that they lose. Obviously, it's been incredibly disappointing. They've lost against Marshall and Stanford. And there's no, no apology for that. Like, it's just bad football. But Mike, I think under the circumstances, losing your quarterback when you don't have a deep quarterback room this season is really a tough thing to overcome in college football. Certainly going to be an area where next season they're going to probably have to make some changes in the portal. Yeah. I mean, I think Buckner hopefully will be healthy if he sticks around. He's back in it, and I'd like to see him play a little bit and see if he can develop more. So yeah, I just don't know what the expectation is when you lose that key player in the second game of the season. Yeah. With a brand new head coach and a new staff for the most part. So I'm okay with it, but that's only if they go 1-1 at worst the next 2 weeks. If it's an 0-2 finish, it's like,
that would be tough. I would agree with you there. As far as, you know, me looking at it, if I'm with you before the season, if you'd have told me 8-4, I would have definitely been disappointed to think about that. I'd have definitely been disappointed. But losing the quarterback and seeing some of the way they played some of the games, I would say, okay, we got out of that first year. Let's go to a bowl game, see what happens. 9-3, to beat three ranked teams in the last six games would be nice, especially if USC keeps winning. They're going to move up because Michigan and Ohio State, someone's going to move down after a loss there. Unless it's a close game, then maybe they'll stay ahead of USC. But USC's a top 10 team right now, so that would be – they've already got a top 10 win over Clemson, and they can get one over USC as well. So we'll see. I think it's been just as Coach Freeman said, an inconsistent team at times. That's something they have to work out. But I agree with you, and we've talked about this before. They may have to hit the portal for a passing quarterback next year.
I also think you can confidently say, as a Notre Dame fan, and this will probably be controversial, Notre Dame, probably the best team in the ACC if they were in the ACC this season. They've beaten both ACC championship playing teams, North Carolina and Clemson. They're North Carolina and Clemson's only losses.
Right.
If they played any ACC team, they'd probably be favored. I don't know if they would win because when they lost to Stanford, the mantra for the rest of the season.
Right.
I don't know if they can win because they lost to Stanford and Marshall, but they did really well against those ACC teams. I think they have still like a 27-game regular season ACC winning streak. So if you care about those things, I think that that's great. And now they can play spoiler to their biggest rival on the road at the end of the season, Southern Cal. And whether or not they win, I don't know if it matters too much to fans because they're not playing for as much as if this were for a playoff spot. But it's certainly a fun place to be. I having just played spoiler to Clemson last week and how much fun the fans had with that, doing that to Southern Cal, I think would be incredible for the fans.
And Southern Cal was my biggest rival for sure in my era and even before. So it would be awesome to see them knock us out or us knock them out. Because I remember that was their goal back when Mike and Jake were on the team in 2012. We were number one.
Oh, yeah.
We had to win that last game to be in the title game.
It happened in 2018 also, the last game when Notre Dame was undefeated.
Right. That's very true.
But, Mike, I think it's also the hopes and dreams of the Pac-12 now rest on that game because of what happened this weekend with the rest of the Pac-12. Oregon losing to Washington in a crazy game. And then, late at night, you were probably awake for it because you're in the Pacific time zone now. But most people on the East Coast probably were asleep when Arizona upset UCLA.
Unreal.
So now Southern Cal is the only hope for a Pac-12 spot in this playoff, which is crazy because midway through the season, it was like, well, one of these teams has got to make it in, right?
Oh, I was – that. Then again, when that happened, it was like, well, that's the Pac-12 being the Pac-12. They eat themselves is what they do, you know, and they just find a way to screw it up. So you're right, USC is the last hope there. So let's hope Notre Dame can spoil that. And who knows if USC can even bust into the party because there's teams in front of them. So right now we have four undefeateds, but there won't be four undefeateds very soon. So Georgia's one, Ohio State two, Michigan three, TCU is sitting at four. Ohio State and Michigan have to play last game of the regular season. So you're only going to have, you know, if the other teams win, three undefeated teams. The team that could really muck this thing up is the team with the guy who used to be Notre Dame's head coach, and that's LSU. You got to give them credit, you know, for knocking off Alabama. They are LSU, which is sitting at number six, is in the SEC championship game with two losses at 8-2. So if they were to beat Georgia, which I do not think they will do, but if they were to win out, beat Georgia in the SEC title game, they're going to be the first two-loss team in the tournament, right? I mean, there's no way they're out, correct? They would have beaten Alabama. They would have beaten Georgia, which is number one in the country. It'd be very difficult to sit there and say, okay, you have two losses, and we never had a two-loss team, and there's a couple of undefeated teams and one-loss teams. I still think LSU would have to be in if they were to do that.
I think so, too, and I think Tennessee fans would absolutely be devastated because of how badly they beat LSU earlier this season. LSU was not in the game at all. It was at home. It was Brian Kelly's worst home loss in, like, 20 years. I think Tennessee fans felt that that maybe made them a little safe since it was such a win over, you know, an SEC West team that's a pretty quality team, even though, you know, LSU wasn't ranked as high at the time. But, yeah, Tennessee fans would be, I think, devastated if they got left out of that. But they didn't beat Georgia, and that's what they needed to do this year to have a shot at the SEC title game.
Right.
So you can't really blame, you know, LSU for it. You have to really just blame yourselves. But, yeah, watching a team that you beat by a lot of points get in there,
yeah, that would be tough.
Would be really tough. And I think there's also, like, this other element that we've already forgotten, that Clemson might end up being a one-loss Power 5 champion, or North Carolina might end up being a one-loss Power 5 champion. North Carolina doesn't have the name prestige that Clemson has, but they might have pretty similar resumes at the end of the season if they both win out, and then, of course, they'll play each other in Charlotte. So that sets up a really interesting scenario, too.
It does, but what I'll say there is I think the committee let us know what they think of North Carolina. I mean, they have one loss to Notre Dame, and they're sitting at 13. I mean, they have a lot of teams to jump.
What if they beat Clemson and win a championship? I mean, I don't think they'll get in. I'm just saying,
if I were
a North Carolina fan, I would not be too happy about that.
I think the ACC might be on the outside looking in. TCU, if they take care of business, they're in.
Just win.
They're absolutely in if they do that. And they obviously, what they have, Baylor, Iowa State, and then the Big 12.
I think Kansas State right now. I don't know all the tiebreakers because the Big 12, like you said, they're
all together.
They're like
no
the Pac-12.
Right.
They're all together. They all kind of like cannibalize each other every season. This team beats this team, and then this team loses and all of that. So, yeah, TCU just needs to win three more games, and then I think they're in, which would be really cool because they've never made the playoff before. And I always like seeing a team that's never made it get in. I'd love to see Tennessee and TCU both in it instead of, you know, your typical Georgia, Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State matchups.
Well, Tennessee is the first team that looks to step up if LSU loses to Georgia. Now, Georgia, LSU has to lose because Ohio State, Michigan, you know, one of those teams is going to stay undefeated. So I think Georgia stays undefeated. I'll say Ohio State just for sake of saying a team undefeated. And if TCU stays undefeated, they're in. And then, you know, if Michigan is not in the Big Ten championship, and then obviously Tennessee is not going to be in the SEC championship, and if LSU loses, they're going to have three losses. Tennessee is in a great position to be that fourth team in there. So that it will be interesting unless for some reason – oh, say Ohio State beats Michigan by a point, right? And then Michigan is watching the Big Ten championship game. Ohio State wins it, and then does Michigan still get in possibly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that might come down to, like, margin of victory. If Ohio State beats Michigan also by, like, 4 or 5 touchdowns, I don't think Michigan has a shot at it.
Don't have a shot then at that
point. But like you said, if it's a close margin, which is it's crazy because it's going to come down to like a weird weather game probably at noon on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and it's going to be probably snowing and freezing and crazy. So that game's going to be really fun to watch regardless. My absolute favorite weekend of the sports calendar is the weekend after Thanksgiving because there's just floor-to-ceiling college football, NFL, there's so much stuff going on. And now this year there's going to be, like, World Cup matches at the same time. It's just going to be totally bonkers. There's usually good college basketball games going on. Next year there's going to be a Formula One race, which I'm not prepared for. But that is one of my favorite weekends of the year. And this year there's going to be a lot of college football playoff hopes and dreams riding on it.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, next week for Thanksgiving, there's the three NFL games on Thanksgiving. I think Friday is when the U.S. plays England in the World Cup. I think. But I know there's a World Cup game that Friday. And then Saturday you have the slate of college games. And then Sunday, obviously, the NFL. So, yeah, it's getting good right now. And again, some of these will take care of themselves. Some have teams have the ability win and you're in. Others have to kind of, you know, wait and see what happens. Certainly different in the NFL, where you can get in with a losing record and go on and win the Super Bowl if you want. It's all about whatever you have to do to make it into the playoffs. Let's start here first, Jess, with a team that I don't think is going to get into the playoffs, but really, really kind of, you know, took over the headlines, and that's the Colts and the hiring of Jeff Saturday, who I will say outright is a great friend of mine. We've worked together, and I love the guy. That he was named the interim head coach for the Colts when they fired Frank Reich. When you initially saw that, this is a guy in Jeff Saturday who's never been a head coach outside of high school and never in college, never an assistant, never in pros, never an assistant, and was offered that job and he took it. And I don't blame him one bit. What was your initial thought when you saw that?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I was really stunned. I think everyone was stunned to see a former player who has not had any coaching experience get promoted to that level when it seemingly there would be a coordinator or a position coach or someone in the building with that team week to week this season who would probably be a little bit better suited to fill that role. And we talked about it with Gojo a little bit last week that it brings up a big issue, which is that this seems to only happen with, you know, non-minority white candidates in a league where there's a lawsuit filed by a former black head coach saying that there, you know, were sham interviews and they not adhering to the Rooney Rule and there's lack of opportunity and there's discrimination in coaching practice and coaching hiring practices. So that was my initial shock, was that I never considered that Jeff Saturday would be up for this position. And also, like, it seems like these types of opportunities only happen to a certain kind of of former player. However, that being said, like, there were a lot of former coaches and players up in arms about it because they feel that you need to pay your dues to get that kind of job. And I'm not really like a pay your dues kind of person. Like, I don't believe that, like, oh, you have to cut your teeth and toil away for all these years before you can do X, Y, and Z. I just think that, like, some people are naturally good at something or might be the right fit for something. And you don't need to just like be, you know, someone who works a 200 hour a week NFL job to be qualified to be an interim head coach for like 6 weeks. But that was just my thought process. So what do you think?
Well, a couple things. First, I just want everybody to understand the NFL does have the Rooney Rule, which has worked for shit as of late, as we know. When you're dealing with an interim head coach, the Rooney Rule does not apply. So, so I just want to so technically they didn't have to go through the Rooney Rule process to hire an interim head coach. Now, if they have to after the season where they're going to hire a head coach, they have to go through that process then. And I have no idea if Jeff will be involved in that. Listen, it was a nice win against a horrible team in the Raiders. They still have Philly to play, Dallas to play, Minnesota to play. I mean, it's going to be a tough road for them. My thought, I understood to a point, and it was Bill Cowher and Joe Thomas, the guys that really were vocal.
And Rex Ryan.
And Rex Ryan were really vocal about this.
I heard a lot of Rex Ryan.
You hear definitely anytime you hear a lot of Rex Ryan. And these are guys that were in it, especially the coaches, so they understand. The coaching circle is an amazing thing. There's part of me that understands it to a point that says, you have a former head coach on the staff, why wouldn't you just elevate him to do that? I don't know what Irsay's reasons were. I know he's great friends with Jeff Saturday. I have no idea. But the one person I don't blame in all this is Jeff Saturday. You wanna say you have an issue with the process, then point the finger directly at Irsay. He's the one that made this decision. Jeff Saturday, hell, who if you want a coach or have any kind of thought on coach, and I know it was brought up that he was offered to be an assistant a couple of times and he didn't do it, yet he took this job. I don't care. I don't put it on Jeff at all. I would have taken the job. Shit, if that Notre Dame job was available, you know, when Brian Kelly left and Jack Swarbrick, who I live right down the street from, if he came and knocked on my door and said, hey, Mike, how about taking over the team, you know, for the year? And so,
I would have loved that.
I'd have been like, hell yeah, where do I sign up for this? Because I was asked to get into coaching and I didn't want to because of that lifestyle. And there's a big difference of when I was asked to get into coaching after I finished in the NFL, I had three very young kids as opposed to all my kids are out of the house now. You know, my wife and I were talking about this because Joe Thomas brought it up, talking about Chudzinski when he was a coach, never saw his kids. And again, I know what he meant. It wasn't a fact of not seeing your kids. It was a fact of the time commitment to be a head coach. But there's still the mental strain and drain of not seeing your family that Jeff doesn't have to go through. I think Jeff has one left, a 16-year-old at home. The 16-year-old, you know, when you're 16, you don't talk to your parents anyway.
You don't want to talk to
your parents. Yeah, exactly.
Your parents are, he's probably so embarrassed.
Exactly.
Right,
I've been through that three times. So he didn't have to go through that mental part of it. So I don't blame Jeff at all for taking the job. If you want to jump on the process, you know, that's on Ursay. But I'm happy for Jeff and the players. I spoke highly of him, saying he didn't come in and start ranting and raving and said, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. He basically said, I'm going to let you coaches do your thing. I'm just going to try and you know, look at things here and there and see if we can improve somewhere. So, and that doesn't surprise me because, again, if you see the positions I see as the smartest on the field are centers in football and catchers in baseball. That's why you see more than a few catchers become managers in baseball, because you have to kind of know everything out there. And I think centers are kind of the same way. So if you're for it or against it, whatever you think, all I got to say is I'm rooting for Jeff. I have no idea what will happen at the end of the year, but your
unbiased opinion.
Yeah. I'm definitely, definitely rooting for him. So we have a bunch of people on a 1972 team in Miami who were popping the champagne.
Oh, my God.
When Washington beat the Philadelphia Eagles on Monday Night Football. You know, I was just a few days before that. We were actually driving from Indiana here to Arizona. And I went on, I think it was WIP in Philadelphia. And one of the hosts asked me, is it better just to lose a game and then have that whole undefeated thing out of your way and not thinking about it? I said, that is the same situation as when you get your bye. Whenever you have your bye, somebody says, is this a good time for a bye? You can justify anything as a good time for a bye. Mm-hmm. So you can justify the same thing about, yeah, let's stay undefeated. That's not going to affect us at all. Or as soon as you lose, okay, we got a loss. Now we can settle in and play the rest of the season. So I'm like, to me, it doesn't matter. You go undefeated. Why not try and go undefeated? I don't think it affects you at all. But they played bad. Washington kept the ball for 40 minutes and the Eagles turned the ball over. I mean, at the end, what I said to these guys is, I doubt they're going undefeated. There's 17 games and it's hard to win in the NFL. And we just saw on Monday Night Football how it can be when you don't play your best.
Going back to your conversation about whether or not you want to stay undefeated, I think, of course, you want to win as many games as possible. You don't hope for a loss. But I think there's also the added thing that, you know, when you're an undefeated team after like 5 or 6 weeks, as soon as you lose, these snobby little 1972 Miami Dolphins are going to pop a bottle of champagne and gloat and drink it and laugh in your face. And I don't want to see that shit. the players currently in the NFL were not alive in 1972. Their parents probably were not even alive in 1972. All right. They don't want to see these old 72 Dolphins popping a bottle of champagne when they lose. So they're going to want to win, even if it means, you know, they have the specter of a loss shadowing over their heads for the rest of the season. No one wants the Dolphins to be gloating in their faces. And frankly, you know, that in itself would probably get me to play a little bit harder if I'm on Monday Night Football against the Commanders, other than the fact that you're playing against the Commanders and everyone's watching.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that I still amazed they lost that one, but they did. So now they're sitting there tied with Minnesota for the best record in the NFC. And that was the game of the year, right? Minnesota and Buffalo. I mean, how that game went, the goal line stand by Buffalo, and then all you have to do is execute a snap. And they couldn't do that, and Minnesota scores on a fumble in the end zone and then wins it in overtime. I mean, absolutely an incredible game.
Once you can't get the fourth down on the sneak,
yeah,
you should not be able to win that game. Like, the fact that they were able to still come back and win, and also we didn't even mention the Jordan Jefferson or Justin Jefferson catch
on
the sideline. I mean, there were multiple catches in that game that I was like, this just doesn't even make any sense. We also didn't even mention Braden Lindsay's catch against Navy, but
yeah.
Mentioning it now, that was also insane. Check out the highlight if you haven't seen that yet. I think I retweeted on Saturday. I think it was on SportsCenter. But anywho, I digress. Yeah. The end of that game was totally bananas. And the end where Josh Allen threw the interception to Patrick Peterson.
Yeah.
That was a little, if I'm a Bills fan, I'm a little alarmed by seeing that. That might harken me back to his rookie years where he was kind of throwing some iffy passes towards the end of games like that and playing a little like YOLO with his passes.
Yeah. Yeah. That was not a good throw. In the last few games, it seems their Achilles heel has been, they've been getting run on as well. So, and that could prove detrimental if you're playing outside in bad weather. When it's good running conditions, that could hurt you. So we'll see. But so they lose. It's amazing to me now when you look at the standings that all the teams in the NFC East are basically in the playoffs. The last place team in the AFC East, is 5-4. That's the Patriots. And that right now is tied for the third spot, the third wild card spot with the Bengals and with the Chargers. The Jets and Bills are in with three losses, and right now the Patriots are tied with a couple other teams. Could you imagine all four teams from the AFC East making it into the playoffs? That would be absolutely incredible.
That seems like it should be impossible, but yeah. It's funny because before the season, all of the narrative going into this NFL season, and the narratives always turn out to be wrong, but all of the narratives going into the season was how good the AFC was because of the AFC West and because of the Chargers and Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen. And right now the best AFC team's probably the Miami Dolphins, at least the one playing the best with their starter when he's healthy, being Tua. And there was like no expectation for that going into the season. And Herbert has been injured and he's played a little iffy here and there, but I think maybe some of that just stems from having a rib injury, which I imagine is pretty difficult to play with if you're a quarterback. Mm-hmm. And then Josh Allen has lost a couple games that you don't expect him to lose going into the season. And then there's Patrick Mahomes, who I think is they're maybe not winning games in as flashy a way as they were like two seasons ago, but I think they're fine. Maybe you're not watching as many Mahomes highlights this year, but they're fine. But still, this narrative of the AFC West being like this dominant division and the AFC being a really like clash of the Titans with all these quarterbacks has kind of not been borne out so far this season.
No, it hasn't. Listen, last year we were all saying the NFC West was the best division in football, and that proved to not be. And everybody said AFC West this year, and it's proving not to be. So let's see how it all plays out. So I'm looking forward to this upcoming weekend's game. I'm going to Mexico City for the first time in my life. I'm calling the Arizona-San Francisco game, both winners this past weekend. Arizona doing it with a backup quarterback in Colt McCoy. I'll be doing the Monday Nighter, myself and Ryan Radke in Mexico City. So, yeah, Chris is coming out with me, and Ben and Sydney are coming out as well. We're going to make a little weekend out of it. So I heard there are great places to eat out there, so we're looking forward to it.
I've heard the same thing. Yeah. That'll be awesome.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that.
Can't wait to get the scouting report on that when you get back.
So, and speaking of it, I'll have to break out the passport for that one. And speaking of breaking out the passport, let's go to Brazil. Now, this to me.
Oh, yes.
You're going to have to help explain to me because, again, okay. Jess is really F1. She has a podcast that deals with F1. I'm getting into it more and more because of Drive to Survive and watching the races. So the Brazil Grand Prix, which was a 1-2 by Mercedes with Russell and Lewis Hamilton. But that's not the story. Max Verstappen from Red Bull has already won the championship. He's won it. It's over. It's done. His teammate, and I use that term loosely in F1 racing when they call him teammates, Checo, was what you explain it, Jess. You'll explain it better than
I. Okay, I'll explain it. So, like you said, Max Verstappen won the championship like 4 weeks ago because it's a points-based system, and no one can mathematically catch up to him now by the end of the season. So they have like all these races left and everyone's kind of racing for 2 through 20. And there are drivers who really care a lot about where they finish in those standings, even though they're not winning the championship. And there's also teams that care a lot where they finish, because the higher you finish as a constructor, the more money you get for the next season and the more development time and all these things. There's all these incentives to do better. So Max Verstappen has not a whole lot to race for because he's already won. He was in sixth place, and his teammate, Sergio Perez, Checo, was in seventh place. And Red Bull really wants Sergio Perez, who's currently in second place overall this season, to finish behind Max in second place in the Drivers' Championship.
Understandably so.
He gets more points for finishing before, you know, finishing higher up in the 1 through 10 where you get score points. So he's in 7, so he'll get more points if he finishes in 6th. And Max doesn't need any points because he's already won. He is the winner. Everyone agrees he's phenomenal. He's the best driver, yada, yada. Great car, great driver, great, well, bad teammate, as we will find out.
Yes.
So Red Bull asked / told Max Verstappen to let Sergio Perez go in front of him.
And they do that with the on-race radio, which is great that you can hear the conversation going on during the race.
They asked him to let his teammate go in front of him on the last lap so that he'd get a few more points. And Max Verstappen said no. He said, I'm not going to let him through. I told you why this summer. I have my reasons. In the meantime, the radio was telling Sergio Perez that we're going to tell Max to let you through. And Sergio Perez was saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. And then they were like, actually, sorry, he's not going to let you through. And he was like, well, it goes to show you what kind of person he is. So that was the end of the race. And it was a very exciting race. Like you mentioned, George Russell won for Mercedes. It was his first win. But everyone's focused on now what's happening with these two Red Bull drivers, because a report came out that there's been bad blood between them because of what happened literally months ago, Mike, 15 races ago over Memorial Day in Monaco.
Right.
Apparently, the word on the street is that Max Verstappen has been holding a grudge since Monaco because of something Checo did in May that he didn't like, that he thought cost him points in the championship. And that's why he didn't let him through now in November in Brazil, after he's already won the championship, that he's apparently annoyed about not getting points for in May. So Checo fans, very pissed off. I think Red Bull fans are also pretty pissed off because they also want Checo to finish in second place. It looks good for your team if you both finish, you know, 1-2. But Verstappen was not having it. So that was a very messy finish to the Brazil Grand Prix, which was a fun race.
How many more races, Jess?
Just one this weekend in Abu Dhabi.
Right now, Perez and Leclerc are tied with 290 points for second. So this race will decide, you know, who's behind Max. And if Max would have let Sergio ahead, he'd have been leading Charles Leclerc at this point. He'd have been in second by himself. So I guess the question to me is, I don't know what happened in Monaco. And if what happened in Monaco was egregious enough, does anybody blame Verstappen for holding a grudge on that and saying, you know what, he screwed me back then, so I'm not helping him now? I mean, because overall, I look at it and I think, what an asshole, you know, for a teammate. But when you hear something happen in the past, again, I don't know how egregious it was.
Well, it was not that egregious. It wasn't great. So what happened in Monaco, which is kind of unsubstantiated, there are some reporters saying that Checo purposely crashed his car in qualifying so that he would qualify ahead of Max Verstappen. Now, there have been attempts to verify that, like ESPN has tried to verify that. Their F1 reporters have tried to verify that it was on purpose and not an accident, but they haven't been able to. So whether it was on accident or not, I don't know if we'll find that out. But what happened was Sergio Perez was in third place qualifying, and then he crashed his car. So qualifying ended, and Verstappen wasn't able to attempt a faster lap than him. So he was behind Checo for the race. And then the next day during the race, Checo undercut the two Ferraris that were ahead of him and won the race in Monaco. And Max Verstappen didn't finish in first place. And he felt that Red Bull should have done something strategically to allow him to beat his teammate and finish with more points. And so the very next day, Max Verstappen's dad, who is a former driver also, wrote on his son's website just that. So that part is not a secret. They felt that Red Bull didn't do enough to give him a position to win more points. Now, I think the thing that you can argue is that wouldn't this all be water under the bridge now that he's won the championship?
Right.
And wouldn't you care more about making your relationship with your teammate going forward copacetic going into the offseason? And I guess the answer to that is no. And then, of course, there's all the people, you know, and this is common in every sport. It's like, does one player, one driver think they're bigger than the team? Do they think they can make decisions for the team and defy team orders and all of that? So that all is going on, too. But I think the more interesting thing is like this weird interpersonal dynamic where Sergio Perez has done a lot to help this guy win.
So that's what I wanted to ask you real quick, because, again, you watch it more than I have for a longer amount of time. In the last 2 years, Verstappen has won the championship the last 2 years. Has Checo helped him a decent amount of times in those 2 years?
Unequivocally.
Okay.
Unequivocally. You could say Max wouldn't have won either championship without him.
Really?
Certainly not last year. I don't think Max would have won last year without the way Checo drove in Abu Dhabi. This year, Max probably still could have won because he really was just faster and he had a great car and all of those things. But Sergio Perez still helped him this season. There were times that Red Bulls told Sergio Perez to let Verstappen ahead of him because they want him to win the championship because he's the better driver, but he's been in, you know, positions where he's behind his teammate. So that has happened this season. In fact, I think it happened in Spain the week before Monaco.
Okay.
Which is why Checo, I think, was determined to win that race. So yes, he has helped him. He has helped him win two championships. You would expect Verstappen to feel grateful for it. Apparently he doesn't, and there's still perhaps this grudge because of whatever happened in Monaco.
Obviously there is. I mean, so I guess that's what I wanted to hear. I mean, if Checo has helped him that much, that one time, even if it was, there was a blatant thing out of Checo to help himself over Max, he has helped Max enough for me to say that's just such an asshole teammate move. But I'll say again,
you said it, not me.
I'll say again though, Jess, now, again, I know Drive to Survive, when you're watching a series, it can be dramatized in some ways. When they sit there and say teammates, again, you could probably answer this better than me. It doesn't seem like a real team-related thing. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of camaraderie amongst my teammate and, hey, how can I help you? It seems like everybody is still out for themselves until somebody gets on the radio and says, hey, let this guy pass you. And then it sounds like they may be doing it begrudgingly, or like in Max's case, not doing it at all and saying, no, I'm not going to do it.
There were other issues this weekend with teammates not getting along. Like the Alpine team this year, Fernando Alonso and Esteban Ocon, they do not like each other from what we can tell from the last few races. But yeah, you're right. It's not a team sport, but it also is. It is, but it isn't. You're on the same team and you're getting points for your constructor and you drive with these guys and you sometimes need their help and sometimes they'll help you. But at the end of the day, you are racing for yourself, for your seat in F1, for your salary, for your own championship, for your own personal, you know, acclaim. But you do need help sometimes, which is why maybe you're competitive with your teammate, but you're not competitive to the point where you're going to do something to hurt either one of you or your team. So it is a really interesting and complicated dynamic. And I think that's one of the things that people are so interested in with this sport.
So last thing, we'll end on this. Next week, is it next week or is it 2 weeks?
Next week.
Sunday. Yeah. Okay. If that put the same scenario up, okay, that that Max is one spot ahead of Checo, and if he lets Checo get by, he will beat Leclerc and win second place overall. So give me the exact same scenario for this last race. Does Max let him go by?
I think so, because I think the blowback from this weekend has been pretty enormous. I think that he will do it begrudgingly, but I think he will do it.
I think I agree with you, because I definitely saw some Verstappen fans on Verstappen's side, you know, giving reasons why they had no problem with it. But I got to believe overall that most of it was negative towards Verstappen. And like, oh my God, this guy pulled this off. So I agree with you. I actually hope it is the same situation.
Me too.
So we can I want to hear the radio. I'd love to hear it. Max, please, this time, could you let Checo go by?
But then what stinks about it is that, like, Max totally can take credit for it
if he finishes
in second place, which is, like, so annoying.
Max would be like, I won and I got my guy second place.
Exactly. The other thing that happened the day after all of this was a GQ cover story with Max Verstappen on it came out where he's literally dressed like Dr. Evil.
So, really? Oh, that's wild.
He's got the whole gray turtleneck and everything.
Maybe that's fitting then, huh? All right, well, I'm glad you explained it, because I was looking at this going, man, I really want to go off on Max, but I want to make sure I have all my ducks in a row on this. So, all right, let's see who wins second. George Russell is going to be out of it, right? It's going to be Leclerc and Checo second and third, right?
I
think Russell's too far behind. He's like 25 points behind those guys, so that's going to be that. So
there would have to be something crazy to happen.
Yeah, for that to happen. So, all right, I appreciate the education there on what went on. And I am going to leave now, because my wife just came home and I didn't get the Christmas tree out yet. So I'm going to be in trouble if I don't go set this thing up.
Go ahead. I'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Thank you.